For Antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 92.7 FM in Austin, Texas, I'm Scott Horton. This is Antiwar Radio.
Favorite son, do you care just what he's done?
Here's another question I've been pondering. What is all this shit about angels? Have you heard this? 3 out of 4 people now believe in angels. What are you, fucking stupid? Huh? Has everybody lost their fucking mind in this country? Angel shit. You know what I think it is? I think it's a massive collective psychotic chemical flashback. From all the drugs, smoked, swallowed, snorted, shot, and absorbed rectally by all Americans from 1960 to 1990. 30 years of adulterated street drugs will get you some fucking angels, my friend. Angels. Angel shit. What about goblins, huh? Doesn't anybody believe in goblins? You never hear about them, except on Halloween. Halloween, it's always negative shit, too. You ever notice that? And zombies. Where the fuck are all the zombies? That's the trouble with zombies. They're unreliable. I say, if you're going to buy the angel bullshit, you might as well go for the zombie package as well.
All right, well. This is Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott, and I'm about as butthurt as I could be over here. And, you know, I guess this is my purpose in life, right? I am the bearer of bad news. Not to steal the name from your show, Till. All due respect. George Carlin is dead. You believe that shit? Which, you know, I guess that's the way it goes, and I'm sure if Carlin was around, he would say something about, well, yeah, that's what happens when your heart stops pumping blood. That's a hell of a thing. You know, I think probably in part because of the recent Tim Russert thing. The contrast here is it's just so staggering to me. You know, fuck Tim Russert, dude. George Carlin was 100 times the man that Tim Russert ever was. Tim Russert was pathetic. Giving everybody with a little bit of power a handjob under the table. And anybody who challenged him, the axe. Or the club over the head. Whereas then you had George Carlin who was, well, he was an example to me. He's been a very important part of my life since I was a little kid, man, George Carlin. And especially after the first Gulf War and that jamming in New York, which I read him before saying that was his first show. Here he was, you know, 60 years old or something. Almost, 55 or something. He said that was his first show where that was finally what he wanted. That was it. That was perfect. That was what he was really going for. That was the one where he achieved his artistic whatever. Well, I was 14. And one of the things that he taught me was that I didn't have to choose between being some Democrat, pinko commie rat in sandals, or some suit-wearing, church-going Republican, you know, peon to the war party. It's okay to reject both the right and the left. They are both completely and totally full of shit, after all. Why should anyone believe in them? Especially a good, you know, 14-year-old kid who's got his heart in the right place, right? Forget them. And it was that show, that's the one where he talks about the war in the Persian Gulf. And then at the end, he talks all about the save the earth and, oh, recycle your plastic bags and all the whiny hippie PC liberal crap. And it was some pretty good stuff. Served as a great example to me. And, you know, actually, I think it was Mudshark posted a whole thing on Google Video the other day of Life is Worth Losing, which was, I guess, his latest HBO special. I don't even know anymore. It's been a long time since I had HBO. Well, I forgot. There's so many different things about that thing. Oh, yeah. Well, what I was going to say was I was thinking to myself that I needed to try to arrange an interview with Carlin, since he's kind of getting on in years and I've been putting it off and seems like something I ought to do. Well, too late for that. And another thing I was thinking about it was, I was just doing some research and looking around, I wanted to see what George Carlin thought of Bill Hicks. And the only thing I could find, I believe it was an interview by Kevin Booth. Maybe that's not right. But I think it was an interview of Kevin Booth. And Carlin was saying, you know, Hicks, I don't know. I think, you know, he died young. It's a real shame. If he lived longer, maybe he would have really, you know, come into his own, gotten really to his point, whatever. And it turned out that what he didn't like about Bill was that Bill was a utopian. Think about it's time to evolve ideas, right? Instead of persecuting drug addicts, what if we treat them with compassion? They're sick people. See, if you evolve the idea, maybe the planet could be a little more compassionate, and then something like heaven might dawn. And Carlin's thing was, yeah. Shoot food at hungry people. Spare me your solutions. And, well, that's the part of Bill I don't like, only I just like Bill around all that part of his utopian, left-wing, liberal, collectivist sort of point of view on things. But for Carlin, it really wasn't like that. I mean, I'm not too sure. I mean, there's some kind of level of caring in there to motivate all that. But ultimately, I think he was being honest when he said that he'd really detached himself. And, you know, it ain't like he was shedding a tear for anybody going through all the terrible shit he described. It was just interesting to watch, you know. I want to see the pits explode. I want to see guys running around with their hair on fire, punching their own head, trying to put it out. fuck. Well, anyway, I don't really believe in angels either, George, so sorry you're dead, dude. Can't hear me or anything like that. No afterlife. The big electron, man. Whoa. George Carlin is now part of the big electron again. And I'd like to just sit here and play George Carlin for 2 hours today, but I got three interviews lined up. I got Glenn Greenwald on, who, you got to pay attention to Glenn Greenwald. If you don't read Glenn Greenwald's blog, you're just cheating yourself, man. This guy is the best of the best. My favorite kind of liberal. The kind of liberal who really means that liberty part, the root word of liberal. And it's funny because there's a lot of issues he doesn't address, so I think it's not even altogether clear exactly how liberal or leftist or centrist or moderate or reasonable or libertarian or anything else Glenn Greenwald is. Here's what we do know. He thinks that the Bill of Rights is the law and that all laws that supposedly contradict it ought to be null and void and that everything ought to be done to punish the politicians who support such laws that are threatening our Bill of Rights. And he's the best of the best of the best on the Democrats' betrayal. Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid and the rest of them's betrayal of the American people on George Bush's wiretapping, which they just can't stop rushing to legalize. So anyway, we'll have Glenn. We'll be on the show. We'll also be talking with Mel Goodman, who, a former CIA analyst for 30-something years, something like that, wrote this very good book. It's Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. And I like what he says in there about North Korea, about Iran, about, well, you know me. I already know most of this shit. So if this guy's coming and telling me, well, you know, there's terrible danger from Iran's nuclear program, I'm not going to get very far. But no, in fact, this guy seems to have his head on straight. In fact, I think one of my questions will be if he's friends with Ray McGovern and the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, because, well, he seems like a veteran intelligence professional and rather sane at the same time. Maybe they could make some arrangements there. And Juan Cole is here. Juan Cole, who speaks Arabic and Farsi and stuff like that. Juan Cole from the University of Michigan. Juan Cole from the Informed Comment blog will be here to explain the real state of Iraq. You know, that war that you don't care about, that war you don't want to pay attention to, that war that you want to go back and pretend you didn't cheerlead and support, that war that you want to pretend you weren't the one telling the pollster on the telephone, hell yeah, I support it. Go in there and get that mean old Saddam Hussein. The Iraqi people are going to be a lot better off. That war. The real state of that war. Juan Cole will be on to talk about that. He's got the Spotlight article today on antiwar.com. And you know what? I ought to take a lesson from George Carlin and lighten up a little bit, right? All this serious stuff. He can talk about serious stuff in a lighter way. And in fact, it's been a long time because I just don't have time in my life for this. But I actually went back and listened to a show of mine the other day where I was just going off. And I know some of y'all email me and say you love that shit and whatever. But I'm going to try to work on my hectoring tone. Maybe I'll stop accusing you guys and my audience of being the stupid Americans I hate who continue to go along with this stuff, for starters. That would be nice. Maybe. I don't know. I got to do something. I don't want to sound like I'm on my high horse because I don't have a high horse, believe me. I'm pretty fucking fed up with this war, though. All right, Israel war games, a couple of news items, I don't remember, Reuters and something else, making clear they had some sources within the Pentagon, unnamed type informant types who say, well, the Americans were in on this, certainly. This was not Israeli pressure on America in any sense. And I think we all probably could have guessed that, and I don't think anybody was arguing otherwise, but just seems that it's clear now that that was George Bush that was behind that when Israel was test bombing. Doing test runs for a bombing of Iran over Greece in the Mediterranean Sea last week. And also, listen, I got a whole bunch of stuff about nukes in Iran that I don't, well, maybe we can cover some of this with, Goodman. But really I wanted to let him talk about his book. Maybe this will have to wait till the end of the show, guys. There's a bunch of new propaganda about, the North Koreans and the Syrians and a plutonium program. I think these guys are starting to read Gordon Prather's articles. And whenever he calls them out on some bullshit, they make up a new lie to confront it. And so we'll cover that. And also, go check out the Stress Blog, my blog, thestressblog.com. If you page down just a little bit, you'll see there, U.S.-backed Jundullah terrorists murder Iranian cops. And those are friends of Osama bin Laden based in Pakistan. Backed by the CIA, as Brian Ross reported last year. Anyway, I don't have time. I got to get Glenn Greenwald on the phone. It's at thestressblog.com. U.S.-backed Jundullah terrorists murder Iranian cops, and I've got half a dozen or so links to important news stories about America backing various terrorist groups around the world. All right, good. All right. Let me figure out some music to play here for you while I get Glenn Greenwald on the line, and then we'll be right back here. It's Anti-War Radio Chaos 92.7 in Austin. This is actually some new Beastie Boys instrumental stuff. I don't know. What do y'all think? Radio 92.7 in Austin. Give me a second. I'm trying to get Glenn Greenwald on the phone here. You know, I was thinking, maybe the reason he's not answering his phone is because he's on the other line doing a more important interview with a more important source, and that all I'm doing is beeping in on his freaking line while he's trying to do a more important interview. And maybe, because I'm sure I got the right number, I should just go ahead and talk about the bogus accusations against Syria and so forth and so on, and see if maybe I can catch up with Glenn toward the end of the show instead of right now. Now, I'm just making that shit up. I don't know. But I just talked with the guy over the email machine, and he said he'd be around for the show. So I'm thinking something important must have come up. Something more important even than coming on anti-war radio, if there's such a thing as that, then that must be what he's doing. Alright, so that's alright. I can still tell you this. Salon.com/opinion/Greenwald. You go there, read the things that the guy writes, and you'll know at least as much as if you'd heard him on the show today. How do you like that? He's been doing a really good job covering the Democrats' complete and total capitulation. See, I'm not sure if that's really the right word for it. They've gone along with everything the war party wants in terms of the just outright burning to death of your Fourth Amendment. But I don't know if capitulation is really the right word, because I'm pretty sure that the Democrats are just simply the war party too. And the Democrats want to destroy the Bill of Rights just as much as the Republicans do. And their excuse is that, well, we were afraid that we would look cowardly. Is really just the best excuse that they have. Which, you know, we are talking about the Democratic Party here, so that probably really is the best excuse they could come up with. Alright, well, now I feel bad because I told my other guest, we gotta bump you, I gotta put you off for 20 minutes and so I can get Glenn Greenwald on here, and now I don't even have Glenn Greenwald on. What a jerk. Alright, well, so I am going to go ahead and talk about Jundullah here real quick. No, I'm not. I told you about Jundullah. There's this terrorist group. They're just like Al-Qaeda. They're buddies with Al-Qaeda in Pakistan. They're called Jundullah. They work for America against Iran. And they've been kidnapping and murdering Iranians for America, which might just happen to coincide a little bit with Andrew Coburn's groundbreaking piece in Counterpunch just a few weeks back about the Democrats approving $300 million to support a Bush finding authorizing more covert support for terrorist groups just like Jundullah, Fatah al-Islam in Lebanon, PJAC in northern Iraq, the Mujahideen al-Khalq at an American protected base in southern Iraq, etc. So, anyway, you can read all about that. And if you go to thestressblog.com and you look at my little blog entry there, U.S.-backed Jundullah terrorists murder Iranian cops, you'll see a link to Raw's story about the Mujahideen al-Khalq, The New Yorker about Fatah al-Islam, Seymour Hersh in The New Yorker there, Justin Raimondo about the PJAC in Kurdistan. The Washington Post is this new one reminding us about CIA support for Jundullah, which was covered by Brian Ross at ABC News last year, and also a link to that Andrew Coburn scoop in Counterpunch about the Democrats giving George Bush $300 million to spend backing these private terrorist groups. So there you go. Go look at that. It's at thestressblog.com. Here's what I really want to talk about while I got a little bit of time now before the next guest. And that is Dr. Gordon Prather. Okay, so Gordon Prather's got a chip on his shoulder about this man, David Albright. And if you're a regular reader of Braun and Sanger and the rest of these neo-crazy media sycophants, as Gordon Prather calls them, at the New York Times and you know, George John at the at Reuters or AP, I forget which one he is, and then there's the other goofballs at the Washington Post. At least they have Walter Pincus at the Post, you know? But anyway, here Gordon Prather's going after this guy David Albright, who you'll often find quoted in major media as some sort of former nuclear weapons inspector, nuclear physicist, this, that, the other thing. And it turns out he is no more a nuclear physicist than I am. And he's no more a former nuclear weapons inspector than you are. And anyway, they quote this guy all the time on all the scare stories in the neo-crazy, sycophantic mainstream media. So Gordon Prather's going after him, and it's about this story about the tenors. You remember Sybil Edmonds and Luke Ryland were on the show we played it for you last week. A couple of weeks back, I recorded the interview. There's this story about the Tinder family and how they supposedly passed these nuclear blueprints to the Iranians. Oh, no. How to make a nuclear bomb. Yeah, but the thing is, this is all about plutonium. This is all about how to make a plutonium bomb. Well, here's the thing. You can't make one of those that isn't really big unless you miniaturize it. Remember in the 1990s, after Bill Clinton handed over American missile technology secrets to China in exchange for giant sacks of money with dollar signs on the outside. They told you Johnny Chung, Johnny Chung, Johnny Chung all day? That's because they didn't want you focusing on John Wong and James Riotti. And because you're a fool, you went along with that. But anyway, after Clinton gave them all these missile secrets, Congress, the Cox Committee, Scooter Libby was the chief aide or whatever on it, and Representative Cox and Scooter Libby came up with the Cox Committee report that was all about how the Chinese had stolen all of this stuff, and especially this terribly guilty Taiwanese guy, Wen Ho Lee, who turned out to be 100% innocent, of course, served as the scapegoat. Anyway, it was great the way they massaged that story, wasn't it? From Clinton was guilty of high treason to you're a racist if you don't like this Wen Ho Lee guy who, you know, geez, I thought we all agreed was innocent. What happened was in that Cox Committee report. Sorry, I got an email from Greenwald here. I lost my train of thought. What happened was this Cox Committee report talked about the miniaturization of plutonium bombs. What they said was you need this tritium stuff, something like that, to boost it in order to miniaturize it. And where the hell are the Iranians supposed to get that stuff? And we're way far afield here from any kind of Iranian nuclear weapons program. We're basically just hanging out in the imaginations of the neo-crazy media sycophants at the New York Times, Michael Gordon, Broaden Sanger, and the rest of these goofballs. And so this is what Gordon Prather says. He says, here's this big scandal, huh? Oh, yeah, these guys are, these terrible people are passing nuclear secrets about how to make nuclear weapons to Iran. Well, why would Iran buy such a design? Albright, to the contrary, Gordon Prather asks at antiwar.com/Prather, what good would it be to them? Iran has neither a tritium or a PU-239 production capability. They cannot make plutonium. They cannot make this tritium that they need to boost it, to miniaturize it, to make a deliverable weapon out of it. And so then what do we get? Like the next day, 2 days later. Oh, and by the way, he brings up here James Ryson's work in James Ryson's book. I forget what was the name of the book again. State of War, The Secret History of the CIA and the Bush Administration, where he talks about Operation Merlin, where they deliberately gave nuclear weapons plans to the Iranians in the hopes that they could entrap them, basically, and have the IAEA find these files among Iranian nuclear paperwork and then say, aha, gotcha. But it turned out what they gave them was operational blueprints for nuclear bomb. They had built-in mistakes that were so obvious, you know, you or I could have figured it out, apparently. A nuclear scientist could have figured it out with a simple eyeball inspection of the paperwork. That, wait a minute, this isn't right. That X is supposed to be a Y. What am I, an idiot? And so it was America giving the Iranians this technology. And, of course, we talked with Sybil and Luke all about, you know, the involvement of the CIA and the AQCON network and the fact that the Tenors were on the CIA payroll, were about to talk with Melvin Goodman about how the Americans covered up the Pakistani nuclear weapons program, hid it from Congress, hid it from the American people because the Pakistanis were helping America finance the Mujahideen in the holy war against the Russians, of course. So they needed to cover up the Pakistani nuclear weapons program so that they could continue to cooperate with them in financing the Mujahideen warriors, who now, of course, are our greatest excuse for even more of the same insanity. But anyway, so now, I'm sorry, this brings me to the news from this weekend. Let me see, I think it was Sunday in Heretz, wasn't it? Well, there's a couple of things. Yeah, it is Heretz here. From Sunday, you can just click on Sunday in the left-hand column there at antiwar.com and go back to yesterday. First of all, they're claiming, oh, we have some highly enriched uranium evidence and some North Korean paperwork. Yeah, yeah, well, they got some stuff from the Pakistanis. It's probably just a little bit of leftover residue from there. There's still no evidence at all that the North Koreans have had any sort of uranium enrichment program. They made their bombs out of plutonium they harvested from Soviet-era reactors left in their country after the Bush administration accused them of enriching uranium without any evidence whatsoever, and forcing them out of the Non-Proliferation Treaty and their safeguards agreement with the International Atomic Energy Agency. So there's that. Then you have report, North Korea built nuclear facility for Iran in Syria. I mean, gee whiz, these guys are fast. Gordon Prather sent me his article Thursday night. I edited it Friday. It went up on the page Saturday. And here we go, Sunday. I'm just kidding. I'm not saying that Mossad makes up this bullshit based on Gordon Prather's articles. But still, it's interesting that the Der Spiegel, the German news magazine, is reporting that what was going on at that Syrian site that the Israelis bombed last September was a North Korean plant to help teach the Iranians how to make weapons-grade plutonium. And, of course, they have no evidence of this whatsoever. And it just seems to me like another one of these pieces in the propaganda campaign attempting to make it seem to you in some broad general narrative, never mind any actual details or facts, but to make it feel like the Iranians must be making nuclear weapons and something's got to be done. How can we stop these people? And it's a never-ending stream of accusations. It's just like Sisyphus, if I'm saying that right, from the Greek mythology. He has to roll the boulder up the hill, and every time he gets to the top of the mountain, it falls back down again, and he has to push it back up again for all of eternity. And here I am in the position of defending the mad mullahs or whatever, who I could give a shit about, only because my government is run by liars and murderers and aggressive war criminals who mean to expand the Middle Eastern conflagration as far as they can to destroy, you know, to take these countries and throw them up against the wall, as per the Ladin Doctrine, to create a boiling cauldron of world revolution in the Middle East. And they're not over it yet. And I don't think Obama's going to save us either. But that's another thing. All right. Well, it's too late for me to get Glenn Greenwald on for this segment of the show. My other guest is waiting. I already bumped him once. But I am going to try to get a hold of Glenn here and see if we can get him on toward the end of the show. It is Anti-War Radio, Chaos 92.7. In Austin, Texas. We still have Juan Cole coming up. And then next, but first, Melvin A. Goodman, author of Failure of Intelligence. So here's some, what the hell, out of place, some Carlin, right? Just a little bit. And then we'll be back here. Anti-War Radio, Chaos 92.7, Austin.
Thank you all. Thank you all. Thank you.
I'm sorry, because this is going to get cut short right in the middle of something funny. But I'm warning you.
Yeah. Okay. It's been a little while. It's been a little while since I've been here, and a couple of things have happened in that time. I'd like to talk a little bit about the war in the Persian Gulf. Big doings in the Persian Gulf. You know my favorite part of that war? It's the first war we ever had that was on every channel plus cable. And the war got good ratings, too, didn't it? Got good ratings. Well, we like war. We like war. We're a warlike people. We like war because we're good at it. And you know why we're good at it? Because we get a lot of practice. This country's only 200 years old, and already we've had 10 major wars. We average a major war every 20 years in this country, so we're good at it. And it's a good thing we are. We're not very good at anything else anymore. Huh? Can't build a decent car, can't make a TV set or a VCR worth a fuck. Got no steel industry left, can't educate our young people, can't get health care to our old people, but we can bomb the shit out of your country, all right? Huh? We can bomb the shit out of your country, all right? Especially if your country is full of brown people. Oh, we like that, don't we? That's our hobby. That's our new job in the world, bombing brown people. Iraq, Panama, Grenada, Libya, you got some brown people in your country. Tell them to watch the fuck out, or we'll goddamn bomb them. Well, when's the last white people you can remember that we bombed? Can you remember the last white? Can you remember any white people we've ever bombed? The Germans, those are the only ones, and that's only because they were trying to cut in on our action. They wanted to dominate the world. Bullshit, that's our fucking job. That's our fucking job. Now we only bomb brown people. Not because they're trying to cut in on our action, just because they're brown. Now, you probably noticed I don't feel about that war the way we were told we were supposed to feel about that war, the way we were ordered and instructed by the United States government to feel about that war. You see, I tell you, my mind doesn't work that way. I got this real moron thing I do. It's called thinking. And I'm not a very good American because I like to form my own opinions. I don't just roll over when I'm told to. Sad to say, most Americans just roll over on command. Not me. I have certain rules I live by. My first rule, I don't believe anything the government tells me. Nothing. Zero. Nope. And I don't take very seriously the media or the press in this country, who in the case of the Persian Gulf War were nothing more than unpaid employees of the Department of Defense, and who most of the time,
I'm sorry. I hate to do it. It's so hard to turn this stuff down, but we got to get on with the show. I'll try to stay on and play some more Carlin for you later on. It's Anti-War Radio, Chaos 92.7 FM in Austin, Texas. Our first guest today is Melvin A. Goodman. He's a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and an adjunct professor at the government at the Johns Hopkins University. He has more than 40 years of experience in the CIA, the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, and the Department of Defense. He's the author or co-author of 6 books, including Bush League Diplomacy, How the Neoconservatives Are Putting the World at Risk, and The Phantom Defense, America's Pursuit of the Star Wars Illusion, 2001. Wow, that one sounds interesting. The new one, the one I have here, Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you, Scott. Good to be with you.
Oh, it's very good to have you on the show here. And I like this book. I could tell right away that this wasn't going to be a bunch of propaganda shoved down my throat. I could tell the way you address, well, the axis of evil countries and your perspective on the Iranian nuclear program and so forth. I could tell that this is the kind of thing I was going to enjoy, and it turns out I was right. I learned a lot of history, and I guess if there's a villain in your book, it's Robert Gates, the current Secretary of Defense. Yes. This is the poster boy for everything wrong with Central Intelligence nowadays.
It's everything that's wrong about Central Intelligence, and also everything that's wrong about congressional oversight, because once again, the Congress wasn't doing its job. They confirmed Bob Gates as CIA director in 1991, even though 4 years earlier they denied him confirmation because they knew he was lying about Iran-Contra, and the chairman of the committee, David Boren, called him at home and told him he was lying, and the committee basically did not believe him. But somehow, these people managed to launder their credentials. There's never any accountability. There's rarely accountability at the CIA, and that's why we're in this fix that we're in. The Congress doesn't do its job. The print media don't call attention to it. The public remains asleep on most of these issues, and now we have a disaster in Iraq that was brought to us essentially by flawed intelligence, false intelligence.
Well, now, well, there's a couple different angles I could go there. I want to stick with Robert Gates for a minute. There are people who say now that he's really the voice of reason in the administration. He's the only one who has the gravitas or whatever to stand up to Dick Cheney in front of George Bush. Do you buy that?
No, I don't. But it, to me, that's a statement that reflects how low the Bush administration has sunk, that Bob Gates is the great white hope of the Bush administration. Because if you have a character as flawed as Bob Gates, who believes in the war in Iraq, and who says we must win the war in Iraq, and has now endorsed as many troops, or actually more troops than we had in Iraq than we went into the country 5 years ago in 2003, and who really hasn't made any changes in the acquisitions process in the Pentagon, which is totally flawed, then how in the world does this man become the best side of the Bush administration? The irony to me in all of this is that the reason why Donald Rumsfeld had to be booted out of his position in December of 2006 or November of 2006 was he had really lost fervor with regard to the war in Iraq. So they had to bring in a fresher face who believed in the war. This is the same thing Lyndon Johnson did after the Tet Offensive in Vietnam, because Robert McNamara realized the war could not be won, so they brought in Clark Clifford to engage the war. Of course, Clark Clifford was also turned when he saw the evidence. But again, Bob Gates in 2006 was brought in because Donald Rumsfeld had lost his enthusiasm for this war. So now we have a war that this administration believes you can win and wants to win, and we have a presidential candidate such as John McCain who also wants to win the war, a war that's already been lost, but that's another matter. And is prepared to stay there 100 years. So is Bob Gates from everything he has said.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that's a very important point. You and I guess Robert Perry are the only people I've ever heard say that, besides myself, pointed out that it was Rumsfeld who was saying, now look, wait a minute, maybe we need to think of this like a welfare program, and the more dependent on us they are, the less they're going to get their act together themselves, and maybe we really need to start withdrawing our forces. That was when they booted him, and he started to sound reasonable.
Exactly. Donald Rumsfeld asked his high-ranking generals at the Pentagon, are we creating more terrorists, or are we capturing and killing more terrorists? And I think when the answer came back, it was obvious that we were creating more terrorists with our tactics in Iraq. So Rumsfeld knew this was a war that could never be won. And actually, having taught at the National War College and taught military doctrine to this group of military officers, that includes the current chairman of the National Intelligence Community and now the new Air Force Chief of Staff, we taught, and they understood, that this war has passed. It's what Clausewitz called the gravitational point of war. The war has been lost.
You're saying that you taught Mike McConnell?
Mike McConnell was a student of mine at the National War College in the 1990s. Norton Schwartz, the new Air Force Chief of Staff and head of the Transportation Command, was a student of mine at the National War College in the 1990s. And it's kind of interesting to see these people take over key positions who learn one thing and profess to learn some lessons about war and the constraints on military force, and now they're in the position because, frankly, because of civilians, not because of military leaders. Military leaders don't take us into war. Usually the wars that we select by choice, like Vietnam and Iraq, these are the classic situations that civilians take us into, what David Halberstam called in that wonderful book, The Best and the Brightest. It's the best and the brightest who took us into Vietnam, took us into Iraq. And, of course, it's the military, which I think has been derelict in terms of what its obligations were, that have gone along with these flawed decisions.
Boy, and that really says something about the state of America's role in the world now, and the role of foreign policy in our domestic life even, that the biggest fear of the founding fathers, a permanent standing army that would always have the incentive to find excuses for putting itself to work, is actually, hopefully, the restraining force on the power-mad crazies from the think tanks.
Exactly, but it also brings to mind something that President Eisenhower said in 1961 in his farewell address, the warning about the military-industrial complex, which was essentially a civilian complex, not a uniform military complex. But it has come true in terms of this reality in which this military-industrial complex is now more powerful and more threatening than anything I think even Eisenhower could have imagined. Mm-hmm. And what a new president is going to have to deal with, and it really doesn't matter whether it's Obama or McCain, is the fact that national security is now dominated by the Pentagon. The Pentagon is dominated by a figure such as Robert Gates, who falsified intelligence on the Soviet Union in the 1980s that led to the great intelligence failure of 1991. And now, ironically, he's commanding a war that we entered because of falsified intelligence. And you have a State Department that basically sunk into a kind of obscurity and a phantom state in which the State Department really has no impact whatsoever.
Well, look, in your book, Mel, it basically seems like the stories of this or that group of analysts stood up and told the truth to the White House are simply the exceptions that prove the rule. That is, that all this intelligence is simply there to help lie the country into whatever it is that the policymakers want.
Well, right, and it's a two-sided coin. The people who stand up with a moral compass and try to tell truth to power are pushed aside and marginalized. And those people who are corrupt, and my perfect example is the speech that the CIA wrote for Colin Powell that was given to the United Nations in February of 2003 to make the case to the international community for going to war. That was a totally flawed speech. It had 28 allegations. All were false. All were shown to be false and demonstrated to be false. Sometimes immediately or certainly within a year after we entered the war, not one person at the CIA, whether it was the director, the deputy director, or the head of the intelligence directorate, no one suffered any negative consequences for taking part in this phony exercise that put Colin Powell out there where he should never have been. He should have resigned, but that's another matter. But put him out there where the country lost all of its credibility internationally because it made a case for war that was shown to be totally flawed and specious.
Yeah, well, now, to even call it flawed intelligence, to me, is flawed intelligence. I mean, these guys were prepared to certify that Iraq was weapons of mass destruction free in 1997, and then Madeleine Albright preempted that by announcing that the sanctions would never be lifted no matter what anyway, etc. And they knew that every bit of this was a pack of lies. This wasn't flawed intelligence. They decided they wanted to believe Curveball and Ahmed Chalabi.
Oh, I totally agree with you. In fact, the irony is if you look at the major intelligence failures of the past 20 years, that would be the Soviet Union, the 9/11 intelligence failure, and the Iraq War, in each and every case, we had the collection there to prevent failure. But as you say, these were people who wanted to give an answer to the administration that the administration wanted. In the case of the Soviet Union, they wanted to be able to tell Ronald Reagan, yes, the Soviet Union, that bear is 10 feet tall. And in the case of the Iraq War, they wanted to tell a president, the great words of George Tenet, this would be a slam dunk, Mr. President, to give you this phony intelligence, which is exactly what they did and took this country into war. Now, I think Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld were determined to go to war regardless of what the intelligence said. But the fact is the CIA made it a lot easier for them by going to the Congress, which essentially was a pushover, given the fact that there's never been an act of real spine in terms of a resolute Congress over the last several years, they were pushed over by this CIA intelligence.
Well, you know, a friend sent me an article the other day by James Ryson, and it was about the neocons, particularly Douglas Feith and Richard Perl, and I don't know if Wormser's in there or not. Anyway, but Feith
Libby is certainly.
Yeah.
I saw the piece.
Oh, you saw the piece. There you go. And they're complaining that no fair. You know, the CIA and the State Department got to trash us for years without us really being able to fight back, as though they don't have the Weekly Standard and the National Review, I guess, the Wall Street Journal. But anyway, it's just not true that it's all the neocons' fault, because after all, we'd sit there and tell Bush that Saddam Hussein was in league with Mohammed Atta or whatever, and the CIA and the State Department would sit there and say nothing. And they never stood up to us on our lies, so therefore they're just as guilty as we are. And I have to admit that it seems like he's got a point there.
Well, he does and he doesn't. In some cases, they did stand up. On the links to terrorism, which was really a Pentagon creation. This was the Office of Special Plans that Douglas Feith ran over at the Pentagon that not only collected phony intelligence, but then distributed to the White House, which was a violation of the charter of the Pentagon. The CIA made it clear they didn't have evidence of such linkage, but then George Tenet himself wrote a letter to the chairman, then chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Bob Graham, saying there was intelligence. Well, he didn't say, yes, there was intelligence, but it was bad intelligence. Some of it was forged intelligence that talked about such links. But you're right. In a lot of issues, they didn't stand up. On the curveball thing, the mobile biological labs, they didn't stand up, but the State Department did. On the aluminum tubes issue, whether these were for rockets or for conventional artillery, and the evidence was clear they were for conventional artillery, Saddam Hussein didn't even buy this stuff secretly. He bought it in open markets with open documentation. Everyone knew this was the Italian 81-millimeter Medusa rocket that they had created. It was for his conventional program. It was legal by all of the UN sanctions. He could engage in this activity. But even Colin Powell went along with this military weapon as something for strategic arms. So there was a lot of fraud that was going on within the intelligence community. But as the Senate Intelligence Committee established a couple weeks ago in a report that most people just totally ignored, and the print media, again, totally ignored, the Senate Intelligence Committee finally released its report on how the Bush administration falsified the intelligence that it was given by the CIA. Granted, they weren't given good intelligence to begin with, but in each and every case, they made it worse. And particularly when you look at the argument that was used by Dick Cheney and Condoleezza Rice and Donald Rumsfeld and even George Bush that the mushroom cloud should not be a smoking gun, there was no evidence of a nuclear weapons program in Iraq. This was well known to the Department of Energy. It was well known to the State Department's intelligence and research, and it was even well known to the Air Force. So the CIA really was corrupting some of the intelligence in this case, too.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing that you mentioned about the Pentagon's growth in power reminded me of that Seymour Hersh article, The Coming Wars, what the Pentagon can now do in secret, and how it seems like in the intra-governmental fighting or what have you that the Pentagon or the vice president's office decided they wanted to punish the CIA, and so they used the phony 9/11 commission as the pressure from below to get the National Intelligence Director seat created, basically, and make the CIA director simply the CIA director, not the director of Central Intelligence overall anymore, and to punish the CIA, and then it seems like turn over more and more covert activities to the military, who don't even have to bother showing up at John Rockefeller's committee there.
Well, I think we always had the Pentagon's de facto control of the intelligence community. The intelligence community budget, for example, is a secret budget that's buried inside the Pentagon budget. So the Pentagon controls about 85% to 90% of the budget. And if you look at the personnel of the intelligence community, they're 85% to 90% of the personnel really report to the Pentagon. They're either uniform members of the services or they're Defense Department officials. But now with the Pentagon's pressure, and Rumsfeld had a lot to do with this, to create a Department of National Intelligence, under a retired, now three-star Navy admiral, this meant that in terms of mission and charter, the Pentagon really runs the intelligence community. And even the new appointment of an Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence, which was created by Rumsfeld in the early first Bush administration, but he appointed a civilian, Bob Gates came along and appointed a retired three-star general to run this position. So if you look around the intelligence community, you have Michael Hayden, a four-star general, the director of national intelligence, a retired three-star admiral, the top leaders of the National Counterterrorism Center, active duty and retired admirals, the undersecretary of defense for intelligence, a retired three-star general. The military runs the intelligence community, and this is exactly what Harry Truman didn't want when he created the CIA and the intelligence community about 60 years ago in the National Security Act of 1947. He said it should be outside the policy process. Well, not only has it been brought into the tent of policy, but it's the Pentagon's tent that is running this show in terms of budget, personnel, and basically the major missions of the intelligence community. And this is wrong. This is going to produce bad intelligence, and it's going to produce not the kind of important strategic intelligence that we need to avoid blunders like Vietnam and the Iraq War.
Well, and it does mean that they don't have to show up at John Rockefeller's committee to explain what they're doing, right?
No, nothing gets explained, and there's really no accountability. But I blame basically the Senate Intelligence Committee for that, because when those oversight committees were created in 1975, 1976, by Senator Frank Church of Idaho and Congressman Otis Pike of New York, it was to provide genuine, rigorous, and tenacious oversight of these secret agencies. And you can't have secret agencies running around in a democratic society. They can undercut your democracy, and we're seeing that. And look, in the last few years, certainly since 9/11, look at the CIA role in torture and abuse, secret prisons, extraordinary renditions. These are crimes, and eventually the Supreme Court is moving toward decisions that I think will establish these activities as crimes. And there need to be accountability. These are war crimes, as far as I'm concerned, when you look at torture and abuse and secret prisons. But again, there's been no accountability in this area.
Yeah, I actually want to play a clip for you here that somebody stopped by my blog and dropped this off yesterday, a guy named Charles Davis. He just, I guess, walked up to Jay Rockefeller with a tape recorder. The date on this is April 18th of last year, and this is just 40 seconds long here. It's a and the question, let me set this up correctly because I edited it down. The question is about the Brian Ross report about American support for the al-Qaeda-like terrorist group Jundullah in Pakistan for use against Iranians. Of course, they're back in the news for murdering some Iranian police over the weekend. Here is John Rockefeller's response.
Is there anything that you could do in your position as chairman of the Intelligence Committee to maybe find answers about this, if it is in fact going on?
Don't you understand the way intelligence works? Do you think that because I'm chairman of the Intelligence Committee that I just say, I want it, give it to me? They control it, all of it, all of it, all the time. I only get, and my committee only gets, what they want to give me.
Is there any way, maybe not you, but somehow, that they can press the administration to find something, if they're doing this, if it may be illegal, like, could there be ways to find out? Or
I don't know that. I don't know that. I deal with intelligence. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Okay.
They tend to avoid it.
Wow. I've never heard that before. That is unbelievable.
There you go.
He has the power of subpoena. He has the power of investigation. He has the power of the purse. They have a chop on the CIA budget. They have a chop on the CIA director, the CIA deputy director, the CIA inspector general to stand up before anyone. And I don't know who Charles Davis is, but I want to thank him for that exchange. And to say I have no control over any of this is unbelievable. And did this ever get into the news media?
No. This is just
this is a small thing
on a blog.
Unbelievable. This is on a blog?
Yeah. Yeah, I'll send you the link actually after
the
show to the guy's blog.
Because I'm doing an update. My book is about to sell out. It's going to go into paperback at the end of the year, and I want to get that into the updated paperback edition.
Yeah, well, and you know that really is the problem when you turn into John D. Rockefeller IV to be the protector of the little guy in this country. I mean, give us a break. Here in the House, we have Sylvester Reyes, and a reporter cornered him and said, "All right, what's the difference between Hezbollah and Al Qaeda?" And he said, "Oh man, I don't know. Why do you have to ask me this on a Friday when I'm going home?"
Well, you know, I blame Nancy Pelosi for that appointment. I wasn't a big fan of Jane Harman, but she was a hell of a lot more tenacious and rigorous and intelligent than Reyes. But
yeah,
Nancy
the problem
Pelosi
was she was investigation for ties to AIPAC, right?
Pardon?
Well, the problem was she was under criminal investigation for her ties to the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee.
Yeah, that I wasn't aware of. I thought it was just a rivalry between Pelosi and Harmon with their bases in Northern California and Southern California that was the determinant. But clearly, whatever the reason was, she's clearly weakened the House Intelligence Committee. And frankly, if you look at Pelosi, she sat in on all the special briefings the CIA gave about torture and abuse and secret prisons. She knew about this activity. She never raised any reservation whatsoever, let a complaint. Now, Jay Rockefeller did write a letter that he claimed he couldn't declassify, as if the Senate Intelligence Committee chairman doesn't have the ability to classify and declassify documents that he has written himself. So, again, the constitutional crisis that we're dealing with in this country is immense, But basically, from my traveling around the country, and I was in Texas a couple weeks ago, the country is asleep on these issues.
Yeah, it does seem like, well, like in the Hiditha case, right? The more they tell us, the less most people want to hear it.
Exactly. And I think this is part of the problem here is that we have a professional military, which allows the people of this country to say, hey, we have a professional military that fights our wars. That is essentially not my concern. And that's why there's no anti-war movement in this country. You hear about torture and abuse at Abu Ghraib, but no one gets motivated by such unconscionable behavior. You have public officials who justify torture and abuse. We now know, thanks to the New York Times, about a CIA lawyer said if a detainee is tortured and he dies, it's because we haven't conducted the torture properly.
Right.
It's just unbelievable the kinds of activities we're seeing sanctioned by our government in our name, the name of the American people.
Well, you know, you talk about the rendition program in your book, the widespread kidnapping of people from around the world, the ghost prisons in that former Soviet gulags in Romania and Poland, in Thailand, ships at sea and God knows where. And the effect that this has, the blowback, that's what you CIA analyst professional types call it, right? The consequences of covert action.
Exactly. And another thing that it does cause is there are countries now that don't want to cooperate with us. And if you look at that, every al-Qaeda captive that we have had and every al-Qaeda leader who we've managed to capture or to kill in some fashion, all of that was done with foreign intelligence liaison. We didn't have the leads on these situations. It came to us from tips from Pakistan, from Saudi Arabia, and Syria. But now, because of a lot of these activities that include, as you say, these are, we give them names like renditions. These are kidnappings. These are kidnappings of people off the street, in some cases Europe. There's a trial going on now in Italy of 24 CIA agents, including the chief of station in Rome and the chief of base in Milan, for kidnapping a cleric, sending him to Egypt where he was tortured without any real evidence about what this guy was doing, what was his involvement with terrorism. And again, if you look at Guantanamo, where now there are still several hundred prisoners in Guantanamo, how many are innocent? The overwhelming majority appear to be innocent of any activity whatsoever, but they can't even present their case. We don't know any of this material. Their lawyers can't get evidence. And it's now taken the Supreme Court 5 years, but they're moving toward recognizing habeas corpus for these people. But will it change anything over the long run? And granted, to go back to Bob Gates when we started the show, he is for closing Guantanamo and moving these people to the United States where they should be in U.S. facilities. But Dick Cheney has clearly blocked that. And so Condoleezza Rice and Bob Gates and their efforts to close Guantanamo have really gone for naught.
Well, in the ghost prisons, too, they brought Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and a few others and said, okay, we closed them all and we're bringing them to Guantanamo. But then there's still reports about ghost prisons around the world. Do you know the status of how many there are or anything
like that? Well, the problem is I just don't think we know. Now, we know there are still secret prisons in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think they've closed down the ones in Eastern Europe, Poland, Romania, and probably Bulgaria, but I'm not sure of the third country. We had secret prisons in Thailand. We were using British facilities in Diego Garcia. You referred to ships that were used for prisoners, and I think we've stopped doing that. But we don't know about the facilities in Afghanistan and Iraq. And we know there was one CIA prison that was built for millions of dollars in Afghanistan, but when the heat became intense on these issues, they just abandoned this facility. So somewhere in Afghanistan, we have built a modern penal colony or institution that, for all we know, is now the headquarters for the Taliban. I mean, we don't know where this facility is. We know it costs millions of dollars. We don't know who's using it. We know that we've abandoned it. So there are all kinds of activities going on that we really know nothing about. And then you get into the work of contractors and the involvement of contractors and interrogators, the lack of any accountability for these contractors. We already know about the Blackwater scandals, but Blackwater, after a period of 4 or 5 months, after they killed killed about 17 innocent Iraqi civilians, all those contracts have been renewed by Condoleezza Rice at the State Department. So they're into the U.S. government for hundreds of millions of dollars as Blackwater is on their way to create probably one of the largest armies in the world, as well as building military facilities in this country, particularly in North Carolina and South Carolina and out west, that are huge military bases and huge military operations. And again, if the Congress isn't going to pursue this, and despite what Rockefeller says, they have the subpoena power to do so, we, the American people, are going to find out nothing about this activity. So we really rely on a couple people like Will Scahill, who's written a wonderful book on Blackwater. You mentioned Bob Perry, who's kept the heat on Bob Gates and the Pentagon. Thank goodness for Seymour Hersh, who in some ways is our only genuine day-to-day investigative reporter and has been for the last 30 or 40 years. The work that you do and the work that several of us try to do, really a small number of people, and they tend to get marginalized by the big print media institutions of this country.
Well, now the work I do doesn't count for much. I hope you don't have me confused with the real Scott Horton over there at Harper's Magazine. He's the one who deserves the credit.
Well, you've got a show, and you've got an antiwar.com site, and so you deserve some.
Well, we're trying here. We're trying. There's so many things on my page and notes here. It's really incredible. One thing, this is apropos of nothing, but you write in your book that the CIA wittingly, I love the term wittingly, it's almost never used without the un in front of it, the CIA wittingly gave what they knew to be Soviet double agent defective intelligence to the White House in the 1980s and even into the 1990s?
Exactly. As late as the Bill Clinton, first year of the Bill Clinton administration. This was after the Aldrich James scandal, which was an incredibly systemic institutional failure on the part of the CIA, and that he was permitted to spy for the Soviet Union for nearly a decade, despite the concerns of some of the operational people who I knew at the CIA at the time. What Ames was able to do was give information to the Soviets that allowed the Soviets to shut down every operation, every collection operation that the CIA had against the Soviet Union. So when we started collecting intelligence, we knew this was intelligence from double agents. This was stuff that was given to us because the KGB wanted us to have the material, and we still sent these reports into the White House, and Bob Gates was doing so as CIA director in that brief period from November 1991 to January 1993, when he was indeed the CIA director because of the Senate's confirmation of Bob Gates. And this led to no consequences whatsoever. And if you look at the CIA Inspector General's report, this was Fred Hitz, who was the IG at the time, he said there was no institutional failure at the CIA during the Ames affair, no systemic breakdown during the Ames affair. That's unbelievable to me.
Sounds like maybe he was working for the Reds, too. You say in the book, too, that Robert Gates, who had helped Bill Casey blow the Soviet Union all out of proportion during the 1980s, he was actually in the middle of his confirmation hearings when the Soviet Union fell apart in December of 1991?
Yeah, I found it kind of ironic that the guy who was trying to make the Russian bear look taller than anyone else in this country took the entire period of time that the CIA was collapsing to gain his confirmation. So by the time he came to the CIA and got with confirmation, it was November, and of course in December the Soviet Union was gone. It was literally history as Boris Yeltsin brought down the Soviet Union in what was essentially a constitutional coup. So Bob Gates, who kept singing the praises of the power of the Soviet Union and the threat of the Soviet Union and the ominous nature of the Soviet Union, he was sitting essentially in the halls of Congress trying to defend these views while the Soviet Union was coming apart like a house of cards, because as several of us were saying at the CIA at the time, including myself, the CIA was indeed a house of cards. That's why it collapsed like a house of cards.
All right, now we only got 3 minutes to talk about the entire war on terrorism. Sound good? What's your assessment of al-Qaeda? You know, I just read this great article by Peter Bergen and another guy in The Independent, And he's, of course, interviewed Osama bin Laden and is, you know, truly an expert. And this article is saying, you know, these guys have a lot of blowback to suffer from themselves. They've killed a lot of Muslim civilians over the past few years, and a lot of people are sick and tired of it, including people who used to support the Al-Qaeda movement. And, you know, it seems to me like maybe the 9/11 attacks, as John Mueller put it in his book Overblown, rather than being the cutting edge, the vanguard of this giant Islamo-fascist caliphate, this was really a last gasp, a Hail Mary attempt on the part of Osama bin Laden to bring America into the Middle East in order to, well, the Ladin Doctrine, right, the boiling cauldron, in order to stir everything up. And I just wonder what you think, now I've taken up a minute of your answer time with my question, I wonder what you think can be done about the war on terrorism in a minimalist fashion so that we don't have to continue down this road.
Well, I think two things are important. One, I do believe that 9/11 was the beginning of the end for bin Laden. And once we get this into some kind of a historical perspective, we'll see that terrorism is not an existential threat to the United States. We can deal with terrorism. And then bin Laden actually made a huge mistake when he attacked the United States on 9/11, because he was essentially routed at the time. And the national organization or the international capabilities of al-Qaeda are not what they used to be. They cannot pull off the complicated international operations such as 9/11. But the lesson we haven't learned, and this helps al-Qaeda and bin Laden immensely, is that you can't fight terrorism with military policy. I think the British learned in dealing with the IRA that it takes police work, it takes intelligence work, it takes international liaison and effective cooperation by both intelligence officers and police officers to deal with terrorism. And the big mistake we made was abandoning the struggle against Afghanistan and al-Qaeda in 2001 to go into war against Iraq. And that self-fulfilling prophecy that Bush made when he talked about Iraq as the center of against terrorism. Well, Iraq wasn't involved in terrorism. Saddam Hussein didn't permit terrorists. He didn't permit al-Qaeda in his country before we entered the country. So we have created the opportunity for the real threat from al-Qaeda, which is not al-Qaeda itself or bin Laden. It's these copycat al-Qaeda groups that you have in Algeria and Morocco and Indonesia and the Philippines. But even there, we've had some serious successes with regard to al-Qaeda, successes in Indonesia, successes in the Philippines, successes in Iraq, for that matter. And even in Afghanistan, you have al-Qaeda hold up in the disputed territories of Pakistan, where they're going to be very difficult to get at. But again, it's going to take cooperation and international liaison and great patience. You're not going to do it with 150,000 troops in a country like Iraq, which has totally destabilized the entire Middle East. And now we can look around and see $4 a gallon oil, and maybe it'll soon be $6 a gallon oil. You can thank George Bush and Dick Cheney for that.
All right, everybody. That's a taste of what you get in this book. It's called Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA by Melvin A. Goodman. He was a senior analyst in Soviet affairs at the CIA for two decades. He later served as a Soviet analyst at the State Department and is currently a professor of international studies at the National War College and a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. His other books are Gorbachev's Retreat, The End of Superpower Rivalry in the Third World, and The Wars of Edward, I can't say his name, and
sure,
the End of the Cold War. All right. Thanks very much for your time today, Mel.
Thank you, Scott. Good to be with you, and thanks for taking the book so seriously.
Oh, yeah, it was great, and I'll get you that soundbite as soon as I can.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
All right, take care. All right, everybody, it's Anti-War Radio, Chaos 92.7 FM in Austin. Here's another quick clip of George Carlin, and then we'll have Juan Cole on the show. Stay tuned.
I don't like words that hide the truth. I don't like words that conceal reality. I don't like euphemisms or euphemistic language. And American English is loaded with euphemisms because Americans have a lot of trouble dealing with reality. Americans have trouble facing the truth. So they invent a kind of a soft language to protect themselves from it. And it gets worse with every generation. For some reason, it just keeps getting worse. I'll give you an example of that. There's a condition in combat. Most people know about it. It's when a fighting person's nervous system has been stressed to its absolute peak and maximum, can't take any more input. The nervous system has either snapped or is about to snap. In the First World War, that condition was called shell shock. Simple, honest, direct language. Two syllables. Shell shock. Almost sounds like the guns themselves. That was 70 years ago. Then a whole generation went by, and the Second World War came along, and the very same combat condition was called battle fatigue. Four syllables now. Takes a little longer to say. Doesn't seem to hurt as much. Fatigue is a nicer word than shock. Shell shock. Battle fatigue. Then we had the war in Korea, 1950. Madison Avenue was riding high by that time. And the very same combat condition was called operational exhaustion. Hey, we're up to eight syllables now. And the humanity has been squeezed completely out of the phrase. It's totally sterile now. Operational exhaustion. Sounds like something that might happen to your car. Then, of course, came the war in Vietnam, which has only been over for about 16 or 17 years. And thanks to the lies and deceit surrounding that war, I guess it's no surprise that the very same condition was called post-traumatic stress disorder. Still eight syllables, but we've added a hyphen. And the pain is completely buried under jargon. Post-traumatic stress disorder. I'll bet you, if we'd have still been calling it shell shock, some of those Vietnam veterans might have gotten the attention they needed at the time. I'll bet you that. I'll bet you that.
All right, y'all. It's Anti-War Radio, Chaos 92.7 FM in Austin, Texas. And, well, I get a whole hell of a lot of my information from the Informed Comment blog of Professor Juan Cole from the University of Michigan. And I'm happy to say that we're featuring his article, The Real State of Iraq, as our spotlight today on antiwar.com. The website is juancole.com, the informed comment blog. And it says at the top of the blog now that Juan is president of the Global Americana Institute. What's that?
Oh, hi, Scott. The Global Americana Institute is dedicated to translating classics of American political thought into Arabic and other Middle Eastern languages.
Oh, that's great. Give us some examples.
Well, we've got a team working on Thomas Jefferson's essays right now in Cairo, and we hope to do a volume of Martin Luther King.
That's great.
These things haven't been done. You can't get Jefferson's essay on religious freedom in Arabic. It's never been translated.
Wow, that's awesome. Well, you know me. I'm going to recommend some Ludwig von Mises and some Murray Rothbard for you.
But thank you.
That's all right. Hey, that's great. That's really great. That's how you wage a revolution in favor of liberty right there. You pass out books, Juan. You don't bomb people.
Well, I agree entirely, and I think the Founding Fathers would also agree.
All right. Now, I like the way you start this article. I can tell in your writing here at informedcomment.juancole.com that you're about as fed up as I am. This article begins, American television loves natural disasters. The Burmese cyclones that may have carried off as many as 200,000 people offered the cameras high drama. The floods in Wisconsin, Iowa, and Missouri along the Mississippi River, which have wiped out thousands of homes, have been carefully detailed hour by hour. But American television is little interested in the massive disaster blithely visited upon Iraq by Washington. Isn't that true? Sadly true.
CBS just admitted that they have no Baghdad Bureau.
CBS has no Baghdad Bureau at all now.
At all. They parachute somebody in if there's a big breaking story they want to cover.
Yeah, that's a top story in the New York Times today. Reporters say networks put war on back burner. About how, oh, it's just so expensive, you know, to have people hold up in the green zone all day reporting talking points. I don't know what's so hard about that, really.
Well, I mean, it's more expensive than not doing it. These are corporations. They're making money.
Right. They're only the same ones who lied us into this war in the first place. It's not like they have any responsibility toward how it turns out.
Yeah. Polling shows that CBS watchers were actually more misinformed about things like Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, so-called, and connections to al-Qaeda, than were watchers of Fox Cable News.
Oh, Is that really true?
Yeah.
Oh, boy. If there ain't some guys committing Harry Carey at CBS today, there must be no honor left in this society at all. All right, well, so let's cover the news then, what the people don't ever get a chance to hear, Juan. Tell me about Iraq. The surge is working and everything's going great, and John McCain's going to give us a victory by 2013, right?
Well, it's just a complete fantasy. It boggles my mind as to how the American public even puts up with this sort of discourse. I mean, we had, in this spring, the number of people killed per month in Iraq varied between over 500 and over 1,000 every month. I mean, this is one of the world's great disasters, and this is after the so-called success of the surge. And we got all upset. It drew us into a war that 8,000 people were killed in Srebrenica in Eastern Europe in the mid-1990s. But that's the number that are going to die this year in political violence in Iraq.
And you point out that a million, according to a few different studies now, we don't just have to look at Opinion Business Research. If you look at the Lancet study, the Lancet Johns Hopkins study from 2006, and you just basically follow those numbers more or less through today, you'll end up at the same million dead Iraqis, excess deaths, they call it.
Yeah. Yeah, the U.S., when it's not that necessarily war-related deaths, but deaths that wouldn't have occurred if the U.S. hadn't invaded. We overthrew the government, dissolved the army, threw things into chaos. And when things are in chaos, you know, you have people take revenge. They know they're not going to get caught. So there's a lot of feuding, and there's criminality, there's kidnapping, there's a lot of sniping. So between that and the militias and the U.S. military bombing the bejesus out of Iraqi cities, which we occupy and over which we have legal responsibility, but we're still bombing those cities, killing inevitably civilians. Between all that, the number of dead as projected by public health specialists since 2003 must be around a million by now.
Well, and you know, in Chris Hedges' new book, Collateral Damage, co-written with Leila Al-Aryan, they have such vivid descriptions by the soldiers themselves of the kinds of war crimes that they commit against the people of Iraq every day. And the most horrifying to me was the house-to-house searches. They just cordon off a neighborhood, search house-to-house, terrorize everybody there, kill a few people, steal a few things, terrorize some old women, and then they leave without having discovered a single insurgent or anything like that. And people are dying like this in Iraq all the time.
Yeah. Well, thankfully, you know, I think the incidence of that kind of procedure has declined somewhat. I mean, I think that General Petraeus understood that it was counterproductive. I think it's something that Ray Odierno pursued, and it's a little troubling that now he's going to be in control.
Oh, so that tactic actually has been waning over the last year then?
Yeah. That's one of the reasons that there's less trouble.
Mm-hmm. Now, also, I think in this article is the first time I've ever seen or heard anybody do this besides myself on this show, and that is add up the number of dead Iraqis from the American-supported war against Iran, Saddam Hussein's wars against the people of Iraq during the time of that support, the Anfal campaign and so forth, his putting down of the uprisings encouraged by George Bush at the end of the first Gulf War, I guess, I don't know if you included the casualties from the first Gulf War, and then from the blockade of the 1990s and the million dead so far in this war, where America's killed roughly 3 million Iraqis at this point.
Well, actually, probably more. We produced 3 million Iraqi widows.
I mean, that's half a Holocaust right there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, of course, I want to be careful in saying that not all of those people were directly killed by the United States, but we participated in the process.
Yeah, close enough. I mean, Saddam Hussein was our CIA's guy since 1958. It was America's government's fault that he was ever the president of Iraq.
It is widely alleged. We don't have the smoking gun documents on it, but it's widely alleged that the U.S. was interested in having the Ba'ath Party in power in Iraq because although the Ba'ath was Arab nationalist, kind of Socialist Party, it was virulently anti-communist. The communists were their main rivals. And so it is alleged by journalists and retired CIA agents and so forth that that the U.S. was very happy to see, and maybe it helped the Ba'ath get into power in order to destroy the Iraqi Communist Party, which was the strongest communist party in the Middle East. That once that was done in the late 60s, the U.S. Relations with Iraq were cool in the 70s, but then with the Iran-Iraq War, the rise of Khomeini, famously, President Reagan sent Donald Rumsfeld to make up with Iraq in 1983,
mm-hmm.
and we backed Iraq as our guy in the 80s.
Well, I remember seeing a document in a, well, actually, it was just in a video. I forgot. I think it may have been Why We Fight, Chalmers Johnson, and they showed a clip of a CIA document that called Saddam Hussein a presentable young man that, you know, at least supposedly went back to the 50s or 60s or something.
Oh, sure. Well, no, it's very clear. The Ba'ath made an abortive coup in 1963, and Bob Comer, who later was involved in Vietnam and got the moniker Blowtorch Bob, he was jumping up and down for joy at the National Security Council, reporting to President Kennedy about how wonderful it was that the Ba'ath had made a coup and how good it was for the United States and mm-hmm. how he knew it was coming. So it's all very suspicious.
Yeah. All right. Now, I know you have to go, and I do too, but real quick, I'd like you to address the fact that the 5 million refugees aren't streaming home. So what does that tell you about how well the surge is working, Juan?
Well, you know, we just had this incident in Baquba, unfortunately, where two Shiite brothers were killed who had come back at the you know, urging of the U.S., and it's just too dangerous, a lot of places. Still, you know, the reason for which there's not as much violence is that there's been a lot of ethnic cleansing. And if you try to reverse the ethnic cleansing and bring people back, you might have a spike in violence. So those millions of Iraqi refugees who are living penniless, without work, their kids are not in school, often there's malnutrition, there's survival sex, in places like Jordan and Syria, they aren't coming back in any big numbers, and that tells you that they're still afraid.
All right, everybody, that's Juan Cole. He's a professor of history at the University of Michigan. He writes the great blog Informed Comment at juancole.com. Thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Anti-War Radio. We'll be right back. Friends, welcome back to Anti-War Radio, Chaos 92.7 FM in Austin, Texas. And now joining me on the line is the great blogger Glenn Greenwald. You can read what he writes at salon.com/opinion/Greenwald. And he's the author of the books, How Would a Patriot Act A Tragic Legacy, and the new one is Great American Hypocrites. Welcome back to the show, Glenn.
Great to be back, Scott. Thanks.
Yeah, it's good to have you here, and I got to congratulate you on just the incredible work that you've been doing on the blog lately here, going after these Democrats in the Congress for selling us out on immunity for the telecoms. Well, and beyond that, let's get to the specifics of the bill. Beyond the immunity for the telecoms, which I think we can address in a minute, specifically, what does this bill do in terms of revising the FISA statute? Or
well,
does it replace it?
That it does is that one of the key limitations on the government's ability to eavesdrop under the old FISA, meaning the FISA that has been in place since 1978, is that the government could not tap into the telephone network or other communication devices inside of the United States without going in and getting a FISA warrant. So it couldn't tap into the AT&T room or into servers, computer servers that carry our emails or things like that. What this bill does is it completely eliminates that restriction. So the government is now able not only to tap into telecommunication equipment inside the United States in order to look for specific individuals' communications, it's actually able to tap into the physical infrastructure, the fiber optic cables and servers and the like, doing a vacuum cleaner search, looking for any sort of communication at all, provided that the person who's being targeted is reasonably believed to be outside the United States and that the purpose of the surveillance is foreign intelligence. So the sum and substance is that there's no judicial oversight for that process. It's the executive branch on its own that makes those decisions. They don't have to prove or even allege that the person that they're surveilling outside the United States that they're targeting has any connection to terrorism at all. There's actually no requirement at all other than that it be for the purposes of foreign intelligence, which is very broad. And so it really enables this massive expansion of warrantless eavesdropping for the international telephone calls and email exchanges of Americans inside the United States when communicating internationally.
Mm-hmm. Now, you linked actually in your entry today to this analysis at Balkanization, Jack Balkan's blog, and he talks about that reasonably believed to be outside the U.S., and that sounds familiar to me. That's officially a notch or two notches below probable cause, right?
Right. I mean, you're already talking about eliminating an important part of the probable cause standard, which is that you don't need to even think that the person has done anything wrong. You don't need to think that they're an agent of a foreign government or a foreign power or a terrorist organization. All you need to think about that person is that they're outside of the United States. And you don't even need probable cause that they're outside the United States. Like you said, all you need is reasonable suspicion that they're outside of the United States or reasonable grounds to believe they're outside the United States. And then you can target them and tap into the American phone network or email server network and monitor all of their communications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, Balkan says in there, whoever was writing there at Balkanization wrote that, you know, the focus on the removal from the courts, the ability to review these things, is actually no big deal because the statute is written so broadly that any court reviewing any of this would have to just give it a rubber stamp anyway.
Well, that's right. I mean, the key under FISA is that in order to be able to target someone, you needed to have probable cause to believe that they were an agent of a foreign power, that they were actually working for or in connection with, a foreign government or a terrorist organization. That requirement has been completely eliminated. So all you need to think about them is that they're outside the United States and then prove that you're doing it for purposes of foreign intelligence. But because that is such a broad standard, I mean, anything that you say you're doing in order to protect the country, you can say is for purposes of foreign intelligence, as you just suggested, then it would be easy to go to a court under any circumstance, anyone you wanted to target, and say that it fits within the parameters of the statute. So it's almost true that whether there's judicial review is secondary to just how broad these standards are for when it's now permissible to eavesdrop.
Mm-hmm. And now you point.
But let me just add to that, which is, you know, the FISA court, of course, it was extremely easy to get warrants under the FISA court. They were successful in almost every single instance, all 28,000 times when they asked, in, you know, every case except a small handful, three or four, they were told that they could, that their warrant was approved. So it was very easy under the FISA court, too. There's still a benefit to judicial review, though, even when it's a rubber stamp, which is that you're forcing the executive in advance to tell another body outside of the purview of the executive branch on whom they intend to spy. And the theory, anyway, is that that will reduce the capacity for abuse when you have to disclose ahead of time who you're targeting. And that form of check and limitation is abolished by this bill.
All right. Now, and then there's the immunity for the telecoms. And this says that the telecoms who conspired with the Bush administration to break the law have retroactive immunity, which I guess the real meat of this means that somebody like James Bamford or somebody who would have, you know, a very credible reason to believe that they would be one of the people spied on, have no standing to sue anymore, which means no discovery, which means no accountability for what they've done in the past.
Right. Nobody has standing to sue. The telecoms get full and absolute immunity under this bill for the spying that they enabled. And keep in mind that, you know, what's so important here is that it isn't just that the government is prohibited from spying on Americans without warrants under FISA. There are specific statutes that have been enacted by the Congress specifically to prohibit telecommunications companies from sharing customer data and enabling access to the communications of customers with the government without warrants as well. I mean, those are specifically directed to the telecoms. And those are the laws that the telecoms broke for years by allowing access to their customers' communications without warrants required by law. So it's the telecoms themselves that directly broke these laws. They're being sued by their customers, people who have an expectation that they will comply with those laws when you sign up for them and you talk on over the wires controlled by Verizon or Sprint or AT&T. And what this bill does is say that as long as the Attorney General goes into court and certifies to a few different facts that we already know in advance he's going to certify to, the court doesn't examine whether those claims are true. The court doesn't ask for evidence proving that they're true. The mere fact that the Attorney General makes these statements in court in secret compels the court to dismiss all of the lawsuits against the telecoms permanently. And as you say, that means we'll never find out what the telecoms did. We'll never find out what the Bush administration did. And we won't get a judicial ruling as to whether any of this was illegal.
So even the judge is not allowed to see the evidence.
The judge is allowed to see a little bit of evidence. For example, the Attorney General has to say in a statement, the president gave written requests to the telecoms in order to do this spying, and the president told the telecoms that doing this was legal. So the judge is allowed, we're not allowed to see it, but the judge is allowed to see the underlying written directives from the president to the telecoms that said these things. But the judge isn't allowed to know whether the spying was really done to stop terrorism or to spy on political opponents. The judge isn't
right.
allowed to know the extent of the spying, on whom the spying took place, the way in which they were selected, what was done with the information. The judge is required blindly to rely on the certification of the Attorney General and the President's statement that they did this in order to deter terrorist attacks.
Mm-hmm. And now, something else, I forget if this was brought up on your blog or over at Balkanization, was the turning over of intelligence information to domestic police agencies as a way for the FBI to, for example, it seems like, get around the Fourth Amendment and still be able to prosecute you.
Well, I mean, just in general, there had been a separation between foreign intelligence gathering and turning over information to the FBI for exactly that reason, that because information gathered by the NSA was so much more easily obtained than what the FBI was allowed to do, because the former was for foreign intelligence and the FBI is for law enforcement, there had been this separation between what the NSA could find and what they could tell the FBI. That separation has been almost eroded completely in the aftermath of 9/11, so that now the NSA is more or less free to pass on to the CIA or to the FBI or domestic intelligence law enforcement agencies information that they obtain. And so the more information that you allow the NSA to obtain without warrants, the more the FBI will learn of it, and just standard federal prosecutors will learn about it, and the more that evidence can be used in the prosecution of just standard crimes. And so it goes far beyond just an invasion of privacy of Americans to have privacy in our communications. It also goes to the core of the Fourth Amendment, which is prohibiting the government from gathering information without probable cause to then use against citizens for prosecution.
You know, a big part of this, too, is establishing the precedent, really, that the president can do whatever he wants, and the Congress, no matter who's the president or who's the Congress, they'll simply rubber stamp this, because, as I know you've explained repeatedly, FISA already breaks the Fourth Amendment to little bitty pieces. I mean, they can tap phones for 3 days and then tell the judge, hey, by the way. And even, as you pointed out in your speech at the Future Freedom Foundation, the FISA court is hardly a court at all. It's a Article II court inside the Justice Department building. It's like a grand jury setup where there's no defense lawyers present, anything like that. So if there were any real revisions that needed to be made for technology, such as a guy in Pakistan calls Afghanistan, but the call is somehow routed through the United States or something like that, we're talking about cosmetic adjustments that anyone could even argue needed to be made to FISA. It was already so broad.
Right. The most disturbing aspect of what the Democrats have done here is that they basically embraced all of the fundamental premises of the Bush lawlessness and radicalism of the last 7 years. I mean, there was a scandal that arose because Bush got caught breaking the law by engaging in warrantless surveillance, and the Democrats' response to that was to legalize what he did and then cut off all avenues for investigation. And there was this underlying premise, still further underlying, that because of the unique threats posed by Islamic radicals, that all of the protections and safeguards and constitutional liberties that we as Americans enjoy need to be dismantled and diminished and in large cases abolished. And so the Democrats embrace that premise by taking what you say correctly was already an exceptionally pro-executive, pro-government instrument in the FISA court and basically destroying the entire framework in the name of keeping safe from terrorism and now allowing the kind of vast warrantless eavesdropping that the Fourth Amendment was designed to prohibit. And so, you know, really what it did was it embraced this idea that Bush had the right to break the law because the Democrats are saying, we're not going to impose any consequences. We're going to protect you from consequences. We're going to legalize what you did. And it's further saying that Islamic terrorism is so vast and such a scary and unprecedented threat that the only way that we can keep ourselves safe is if we give up our core constitutional liberties. And those premises have, you know, traveled very quickly from being secret Bush administration policies to the bipartisan consensus of our political class. That's really more than anything what this bill represents.
All right. Now, please let me keep you just one or two more minutes, Glenn.
Sure, sure.
I want to ask you about, it was really a major theme of your speech at the Future Freedom Foundation conference a few weeks back, and it's something that you've just been kicking ass in practice on your blog here, and that is the political realignment. That is, as the conservative Democrats and the liberal Republicans, the extremists in the so-called moderate center come together to destroy our Bill of Rights, the libertarian center on the other side, between the best of the left and the best of the right and the real libertarians are coming together in order to stop this thing, and you're at the forefront of this. So if you can just address, maybe in the ideological sense, the realignment a little bit, and then the nuts and bolts of this campaign that you've put together with these broad and disparate forces to oppose this measure in the United States Congress.
Yeah, you know, I think it's, really interesting. One of the things that prompted me to really pursue this as vigorously as I have, I mean, this has been a theme of mine for quite some time, but, there's an interesting political uproar taking place in Great Britain where the government, the Labour government, the left-wing Labour government, is demanding the power to detain people for 42 days, for essentially 6 weeks, rather than for 4 weeks, which is already an amazing amount of time, without even bothering to charge them with any crime. So in Britain, the government can show up at your house, arrest you, doesn't have to give you a single reason why they're arresting you, doesn't have to charge you with a crime, and can stick you in a cage for 4 weeks, and the left-wing Labour government wants to increase that to 6 weeks. And this is, you know, the four-week detention power was something that was enacted in the wake of the July 7th subway attack there, and the government then exploited the fear, the Labour government exploited that fear and got these powers. Now they want to ratchet it up to 6 weeks, and there's a lot of opposition to this effort that's coming from the left wing of the Labour Party, opposed to increasing detention power, government power, and to the right wing of the Tory Party, the libertarian leading faction within the right wing Conservative Party, Margaret Thatcher's party, John Major's party. And there's a leading member of parliament who's a member of the right-wing Tory party that has resigned his seat in protest and said that he's going to run for re-election exclusively on the grounds of opposing excesses of the surveillance state, the cameras on every corner, the ability of the government to spy on people with no oversight. And while the party establishment, both the left and right party establishment, support these government power increases, people who are opposed to the establishment on both the left and the right have banded together behind his campaign and is really causing a major public debate over there for the first time over the government sprawling surveillance powers. And, you know, I think that that alliance, that coalition is exactly the coalition that has sort of been emerging in the United States as well, where you have, you know, factions within the Democratic Party that have been most vocal about opposing the Bush excesses, and factions within the libertarian element, the Republican Party and without, who have been vigorously opposing these as well, who ought to come together, and I think are now coming together, in order to oppose a sort of Democratic-Republican joint effort to destroy civil liberties and constitutional rights and the rule of law, and create this sprawling, lawless surveillance state. And, you know, the campaign that we're doing, we're working with the people who were behind the Ron Paul money bombs and other libertarians and liberals as well, to target the people who are responsible for this FISA bill and remove them from power, with this sort of goal of a longer-term coalition to protect civil liberties from this bipartisan onslaught.
Well, and you know, you have an entry there on your blog at Salon.com. Again, it's salon.com/opinion/Greenwald, and this is sort of lamenting some of your friends on the left all of a sudden have decided that the FISA bill ain't so bad since Barack Obama's decided he's for it. And I just wanted to let you know, Glenn, it's going to be rough watching your allies in favor of the Bill of Rights defect in favor of power. It happened to me. I had allies on the right in the 1990s who turned out to be a bunch of red state fascists, or if they stayed anti-government, they became a bunch of, you know, Jew-hating 9/11 kook goofballs. And you're going to have the same problem here on the left as your allies defect in favor of their candidate.
Well, you know, ultimately, at the end of the day, my allies are people who believe in the Constitution and core civil liberties. And, you know, I think that remains to be seen. And, you know, I think, you know, there were a lot of liberal bloggers, for example, who have been extremely supportive of Obama, who became very critical of him when he announced that he was going to support this FISA bill. And even MoveOn.org, which has probably been the leading pro-Obama instrument throughout the primary, is reasonably angry at Obama for having done this and leading a campaign to demand that he lead a filibuster and the like. At the same time, there's a large segment who have been of the left who have been railing against the Bush shredding of the Constitution and attacking even, you know, Democrats, conservative Democrats like Jay Rockefeller and Steny Hoyer for enabling the Bush administration and being complicit. And you're right, the minute that Obama came out and announced that he was going to support this bill, suddenly they found all kinds of excuses why this bill isn't so bad after all, while it might actually be a good thing. And most disturbingly, how they, I saw a lot of this sentiment that, well, if Obama's president, we don't need to worry about abuses of power because he's a good person and doesn't intend to abuse his power. And it's that kind of blind faith and blind trust being vested in the leader that I think has, you know, led to all the excesses and authoritarian abuses of the Bush era that you see now popping up around Obama as well. But I really think that large parts of the left have become quite cynical and skeptical, healthily so, of trusting government leaders as a result of the last 7 years. And I think and I hope that that will endure no matter who the president is, and my allies are the people in whom that skepticism will endure, regardless of the political party that controls the White House.
Right, and that's how it always is, as the parties switch back and forth, who has the power. The people who really care about liberty, we all get shaken out, and we're becoming this new realignment.
Yeah, you know, we'll see how it plays out. I mean, I think that, you know, Barack Obama has some instincts that are good instincts. I mean, he has a background in constitutional law. He seems very conversant in the underlying values of it, seems, you know, authentic and passionate when he talks about them at times. You know, at the same time, he's been showing lots of attributes that are those of the conventional politician, and the hallmark of a conventional politician is that they crave political power and never believe that they can have too much of it because they believe that they're good and there's no danger in increasing their own power. And so I think those instincts are going to conflict in him. And, you know, it remains to be seen how they play out. At the end of the day, you know, the one theme that is common to all of the founders is that we don't trust in any men, any one man or any group of men with unchecked power. That the assumption ought to be that they're going to abuse it. And the only real viable option is to make sure that there are real checks and limits on their power. Not checks and limits by trusting in the promises that they make, but in enforcing the constitutional limitations that as a country we've all agreed to. And that's just as important no matter who the president is or what party he belongs to.
Hear, hear. All right, everybody. You can read stuff just like that at salon.com/opinion/Greenwald. The new book is Great American Hypocrites. It's obviously about the conservative movement, right? All right. Thank you very much for coming on the show and for all the work that you do on the blog there, Glenn. It's incredible stuff, and I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Scott. Anytime.
All right, folks. That's Anti-War Radio. I'm going to leave you all with a little bit more George Carlin, and DJ No Home is up next with the light lunch.
Bombing some small country that only has a marginally effective air force? Seems to me like we're weeks overdue to drop high explosives on helpless civilians.
Oops, I missed the first part there. Let me start that over.
People who have no argument with us.
This happens. It happens.
Start bombing some small country that only has a marginally effective air force? Seems to me like we're weeks overdue to drop high explosives on helpless civilians. People who have no argument with us whatsoever. I think we ought to be out there doing what we do best, gang, making large holes in other people's countries. I hate to be repetitious, but we are a warlike lot. We can't stand it not to be fucking with somebody. We couldn't wait for that Cold War to be over, could we? Couldn't wait for the Cold War to be over so we can go and play with our toys in the sand. Go and play with our toys in the sand. And when we're not invading some sovereign nation or setting it on fire from the air, which is more fun for our Nintendo pilots, then we're usually declaring war on something here at home. What did we do wrong in Vietnam? We pulled out. Not a very manly thing to do, is it? When you're fucking people, you gotta stay in there and fuck them good. Fuck them all the way. Fuck them till the end. Fuck them to death. Fuck them to death. Fuck them to death. Stay in there and keep fucking them until they're all dead. We left a few women and children alive in Vietnam, and we haven't felt good about ourselves since. That's why in the Persian Gulf, George Bush had to say, this will not be another Vietnam. Well, I know some people don't like you to talk about those things. I know that. Some people don't like you to mention certain things. Some people don't want you to say this. Some people don't want you to say that. Some people think if you mention some things, they might happen. Some people are really fucking stupid. Did you ever notice that? How many really stupid people you run into during the day? God damn, there's a lot of stupid bastards walking around. Carry a little pad and pencil with you. You wind up with 30 or 40 names by the end of the day. Look at it this way. Think of how stupid the average person is, and then realize half of them are stupider than that. And it doesn't take you very long to spot one of them, does it? Take you about 8 seconds. You'll be listening to some guy. You say, this guy is fucking stupid. Then there are some people, they're not stupid, they're full of shit. That doesn't take very long to spot either, does it? Take you about the same amount of time. You'll be listening to some guy and say, well, he's fairly intelligent. He's full of shit. Then there are some people, they're not stupid, they're not full of shit, they're fucking nuts! Dan Quayle is all three! All three! Stupid, full of shit, and fucking nuts! And where did he get that wife of his? Have you taken a good look at that Marilyn Quayle? Where did he get her? At a Halloween party or something? She looks like Prince Charles, for Christ's sakes. Let me ask you something. Does he actually have to fuck that woman? Huh? God help him. I wouldn't fuck her with a stolen dick. That's my political humor. People like it when you're topical. Thank you very much. Well, tell you what. Now, to balance the scale, I'd like to talk about some things that bring us together. Things that point out our similarities instead of our differences. Because that's all you ever hear about in this country is our differences. That's all the media and the politicians are ever talking about, the things that separate us. Things that make us different from one another. That's the way the ruling class operates in any society. They try to divide the rest of the people. They keep the lower and the middle classes fighting with each other so that they, the rich, can run off with all the fucking money. Fairly simple thing happens to work. You know, anything different, that's what they're going to talk about. Race, religion, ethnic and national background, jobs, income, education, social status, sexuality. Anything you can do, keep us fighting with each other so that they can keep going to the bank. You know how I describe the economic and social classes in this country? The upper class keeps all of the money, pays none of the taxes. The middle class pays all of the taxes, does all of the work. The poor are there just to scare the shit out of the middle class. Keep them showing up at those jobs. Then there are some things you don't want to hear. Some things you just flat don't want to hear. You don't want to come home from work and hear,
"Honey, remember how we told the children never to play on the railroad tracks?"
You don't want to be sitting in your doctor's office and hear this. "Well, Jim, there's no reason why you shouldn't live another 20 to 30 years. However, you will be bleeding constantly from both eyes." Here's something I don't want to hear. "I'm pregnant, you're the father, and I'm going to kill all three of us." Calm down, have some dip.
"Honey, it's the police. They have a search warrant, and the 300 kilos of cocaine are still sitting out in the living room."
Here's something nobody wants to hear. Nobody wants to hear this. Try to think back to when this was appropriate to your life. You and your fiancé have been invited to your mom and dad's house for dinner for the first time. Halfway through dinner, your fiancé stands up and says,
"I'll be right back. I gotta take a dump."
There seems to be no really genteel way of announcing publicly a dump. And frankly, I'm not impressed with people who tell me what they're going to do when they go to the bathroom in the first place. Doesn't that bother you, people who announce that, "I'll be right back, I'm going to take a shit"? Never mind! Do what you have to do and leave me out of it. And don't describe it when you come back. "Boy, you should have seen..." Never mind! "It set off the smoke alarm." Never mind!
I appreciate that. Good to have a little sip of this. The water, I assume, is still safe to drink in New York, huh? Actually, I gotta be fair with you. I'm only setting you up a little bit. It's just not a trick question, but it's just a setup because I don't really care about the water, to tell you the truth. I just love to hear the answer to that question. I ask that question everywhere I go. Everywhere I go, I say, "How's the water?" Haven't gotten a positive answer yet. Not one. Last year I was in 40 states, 100 cities. Not one audience was able to say to me, "Yes, enjoy some of our fine local water. It is pure and it is good." Of course, I know a lot of people don't talk that way anymore, but nobody trusts the local water supply. Nobody. And that amuses me. I like that. I admit I'm a bit perverted, but it amuses me that no one can really trust the water anymore. And the thing I like about it the most is it means the system is beginning to collapse, and everything is slowly breaking down. I enjoy chaos and disorder. Not just because they help me professionally. They're also my hobby. You see, I'm an entropy fan. I'm an entropy fan. When I first heard of entropy in high school science, I was attracted to it immediately. When they told me that in nature, all systems are breaking down, I thought, what a good thing. What a good thing. Perhaps I can make some small contribution in this area myself. And of course, it's not just in nature. In this country, the whole social structure just beginning to collapse. You watch. Just beginning now to come apart at the edges and the seams. And the thing I like about that is that it means it makes the news on television more interesting, makes the television news more exciting, makes it more fun. I watch television news for one thing and one thing only, entertainment. That's all I want from the news, entertainment. You know my favorite thing on television? Bad news. Bad news and disasters and accidents and catastrophes. I want to see some explosions and fires. I want to see shit blowing up and bodies flying around. I'm not interested in the budget. I don't care about tax negotiations. I don't want to know what country the fucking Pope is in. But you show me a hospital that's on fire and people on crutches are jumping off the roof and I'm a happy guy! I'm a happy guy! I'm a happy guy! I want to see a paint factory blowing up. I want to see an oil refinery explode. I want to see a tornado hit a church on Sunday. I want to see some guy running to the Kmart with an automatic weapon firing at the clerks. I want to see thousands of people in the street killing policemen. I want to hear about a nuclear meltdown. I want to know the stock market dropped 2,000 points in one day. I want to see people under pressure. Sirens, flames, smoke, bodies, graves being filled, parents weeping, exciting shit. My kind of TV. I just want some entertainment. It's just the kind of guy I am. It's the kind of guy I am. You know what I love the most? When big chunks of concrete and fiery wood are falling out of the sky and people are running around trying to get out of the way. Exciting shit. That's why I watch auto racing. That's the only reason I watch auto racing. I'm waiting for some accidents, man. I want to see some cars on fire. I don't care about a bunch of redneck jack-offs driving 500 miles in a circle. 500 miles in a circle? Children can do that, for Christ's sake. Doesn't impress me. I want to see some schmuck with his hair on fire running around punching his own head, trying to put it out. I want to see the pits explode. I want to see a car doing a 200-mile-an-hour cartwheel. Hey, where else besides auto racing am I going to see a 23-car collision and not be in the son of a bitch? And if a car flies out of control, lands in the stands, and kills 50 spectators, fine. Fuck them. Serves them right. They paid to get in. Let them take their chances with everybody else. Just means more fun for me. More fun for me. Hey, at least I admit it. At least I admit it. Most people won't admit to those feelings. Most people see something like that on television, they'll say, oh, isn't that awful? Isn't that too bad? Lying asshole. Lying assholes. You love it and you know it. Explosions are fun. And hey, the closer the explosion is to your house, the more fun it is. Did you ever notice that? Sometimes you have the TV on and you're working around the house. Some guy comes on television and says, 6,000 people were killed in an explosion today. You say, where, where? He says, in Pakistan. You say, oh, fuck Pakistan. Too far away to be any fun. But if he says it happened in your hometown, you'll say, whoa, hot shit, come on, Dave, let's go look at the bodies. Let's go look at the bodies. I love bad news. I love bad news. Hey, the more bad news there is, the faster this system collapses. Fine by me. Fine by me. Don't bother my ass. Don't bother my ass, none. I'm glad the water sucks. I'm glad it sucks. You know what I do about it? I drink it. Unless it really smells, if it really smells a lot like sulfur, then I might buy a soda. But it's got to be a soda loaded with chemical additives. I like a lot of chemical additives in the things I eat and drink. See, I'm not one of these people who's worried about everything. You got people like this around you. Country's full of them now. People walking around all day long, every minute of the day, worried about everything. Worried about the air, worried about the water, worried about the soil. Worried about insecticides, pesticides, food additives, carcinogens. Worried about radon gas, worried about asbestos. Worried about saving endangered species. Let me tell you about endangered species, all right? Saving endangered species is just one more arrogant attempt by humans to control nature. It's arrogant meddling. It's what got us in trouble in the first place. Doesn't anybody understand that? Interfering with nature. Way over 90% of all the species that have ever lived on this planet, ever lived, are gone. Whee! They're extinct. We didn't kill them all. They just disappeared. That's what nature does. They disappear these days at the rate of 25 a day. And I mean regardless of our behavior. Irrespective of how we act on this planet, 25 species that were here today will be gone tomorrow. Let them go gracefully. Leave nature alone. Haven't we done enough? We're so self-important. So self-important. Everybody's going to save something now. Save the trees. Save the bees. Save the whales. Save those snails. And the greatest arrogance of all, save the planet. What? Are these fucking people kidding me? Save the planet? We don't even know how to take care of ourselves yet. We haven't learned how to care for one another. We're going to save the fucking planet? I'm getting tired of that shit. Tired of that shit. I'm tired of fucking Earth Day. I'm tired of these self-righteous environmentalists, these white bourgeois liberals who think the only thing wrong with this country is there aren't enough bicycle paths. People trying to make the world safe for their Volvos. Besides, environmentalists don't give a shit about the planet. They don't care about the planet. Not in the abstract, they don't. Not in the abstract, they don't. You know what they're interested in? A clean place to live. Their own habitat. They're worried that someday in the future they might be personally inconvenienced. Narrow, unenlightened self-interest doesn't impress me. Besides, there is nothing wrong with the planet. Nothing wrong with the planet. The planet is fine. The people are fucked. Difference. Difference. The planet is fine. Compared to the people, the planet is doing great. It's been here 4.5 billion years. Do you ever think about the arithmetic? Planet has been here 4.5 billion years. We've been here, what, 100,000? Maybe 200,000? And we've only been engaged in heavy industry for a little over 200 years. 200 years versus 4.5 billion. And we have the conceit to think that somehow we're a threat? That somehow we're going to put in jeopardy this beautiful little blue-green ball that's just a-floating around the sun? The planet has been through a lot worse than us. Been through all kinds of things worse than us. Been through earthquakes, volcanoes, plate tectonics, continental drift, solar flares, sunspots, magnetic storms, the magnetic reversal of the poles. Hundreds of thousands of years of bombardment by comets and asteroids and meteors, worldwide floods, tidal waves, worldwide fires, erosion, cosmic rays, recurring ice ages, and we think some plastic bags and some aluminum cans are going to make a difference? The planet isn't going anywhere. We are. We're going away. Pack your shit, folks. We're going away. And we won't leave much of a trace either. Thank God for that. Maybe a little styrofoam. Maybe. Little styrofoam. Planet will be here and we'll be long gone. Just another failed mutation. Just another closed-end biological mistake. An evolutionary cul-de-sac. The planet will shake us off like a bad case of fleas. A surface nuisance. You want to know how the planet's doing? Ask those people at Pompeii who are frozen into position from volcanic ash. How the planet's doing. Want to know if the planet's all right? Ask those people in Mexico City or Armenia or 100 other places buried under thousands of tons of earthquake rubble if they feel like a threat to the planet this week. How about those people in Kilauea, Hawaii who build their homes right next to an active volcano and then wonder why they have lava in the living room? The planet will be here for a long, long, long time after we're gone, and it will heal itself, it will cleanse itself, because that's what it does. It's a self-correcting system. The air and the water will recover, the earth will be renewed, and if it's true that plastic is not degradable, well, the planet will simply incorporate plastic into a new paradigm, the earth plus plastic. The Earth doesn't share our prejudice towards plastic. Plastic came out of the Earth. The Earth probably sees plastic as just another one of its children. Could be the only reason the Earth allowed us to be spawned from it in the first place. It wanted plastic for itself. Didn't know how to make it. Needed us. Could be the answer to our age-old egocentric philosophical question, why are we here? Plastic. Asshole. So, the plastic is here. Our job is done. We can be phased out now. And I think that's begun. Don't you think that's already started? I think, to be fair, the planet sees us as a mild threat, something to be dealt with, and the planet can defend itself in an organized collective way, the way a beehive or an ant colony can, a collective defense mechanism. The planet will think of something. What would you do if you were the planet? How would you defend yourself against this troublesome, pesky species? Let's see, viruses. Viruses might be good. They seem vulnerable to viruses. And viruses are tricky, always mutating and forming new strains whenever a vaccine is developed. Perhaps this first virus could be one that compromises the immune system of these creatures. Perhaps a human immunodeficiency virus, making them vulnerable to all sorts of other diseases and infections that might come along. And maybe it could be spread sexually, making them a little reluctant to engage in the act of reproduction. Well, that's a poetic note. And it's a start. And I can dream, can't I? See, I don't worry about the little things. Bees, trees, whales, snails. I think we're part of a greater wisdom than we will ever understand. A higher order. Call it what you want. Know what I call it? The big electron. The big electron. Whoa. 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 It doesn't punish. It doesn't reward. It doesn't judge at all. It just is. And so are we. For a little while. Thanks for being here with me for a little while tonight. Thank you. Thank you very much.